Hello and welcome to Pod Rights, a series of podcasts from the Australian Human Rights Commission. I'm Graham Innes, the Disability Discrimination Commissioner. In October this year, the Senate Community Affairs Committee announced its intention to consider the involuntary sterilisation of people with disability. The Commission and various other organisations in the disability field have been concerned for some time that, despite the requirement for authorisation for sterilisation of girls and women with disability from the Family Court of Australia or from state guardianship tribunals, the practice of non-therapeutic sterilisation of women and girls with disability continues to occur. Exact figures within the health sector are difficult to obtain. But the anecdotal evidence received suggests that the practice still occurs both formally and informally. To discuss this issue with me today is Carolyn Fermata, the Executive Director of Women with Disabilities Australia. Women with Disabilities Australia, or WIDA as they are well known, is the national peak body that represents women and girls with disability in Australia. And Carolyn has been the CEO for more than a decade, and WIDA has been undertaking research and advocacy work for almost all of that time to stop forced or coerced sterilisation of women and girls with disability in Australia. WIDA has very much taken the lead on this issue. Carolyn joins us by phone from Hobart, so welcome to Pod Rights, Carolyn.
Thank you very much, Graham, and thanks for having me.
So, Carolyn, I guess the first thing that we should do is to make sure that we all know what we're talking about. What do we mean when we talk about forced or coerced sterilisation of women and girls with disability?
Okay, so what we mean by that is for minors, those under the age of 18 years, we're talking about sterilisation in the surgical sterilisation in the absence of any threat to health or life. Mm. And in the case of adults with disabilities, we're talking about in the absence of their free and informed consent. So, that's what we mean when we talk about non-therapeutic sterilisation. In the case of minors, our position has always been that nobody has the right to make that decision for a child. That's actually an issue, in a sense, a bit regardless of disability, that no mm. child can be sterilised in the absence of a threat to life or health.
Right. And it's not just a surgical procedure, is it, that we're talking about? We're talking more broadly than that.
Yes, and in certainly in Australia, from our research and evidence and anecdotal reports to WIDA, there are this issue is very wide-ranging, and it involves other practices such as menstrual suppression, which is a practice that's fairly widespread in particularly in institutions and group homes and things like that, where women with disabilities and girls with disabilities are given injectable contraceptives, things like Depo-Provera injections, which in other countries have been banned many years ago, but also things like the contraceptive pill, where they're given that on a ongoing basis without the use of the sugar tablets, so that essentially they never get to have a period. Mm. And those things are often done, the language that's used is often around the best interests of the young girl or the young woman, but in actual fact it's often around the best interests of everybody else, so that in a sense it makes it easier to look after a young woman with a disability, particularly intellectual disabilities in group homes, if you don't have to deal with that messy thing called menstruation.
Yes, yeah. Are you able, Carolyn, to share some real stories of women or girls with disability who've experienced these procedures without, of course, identifying anyone in particular, and tell us about the impact that the procedures can have?
Well, again, I think that, this is an issue that has a long history. In Australia, we have members of our organisation who have been, surgically sterilised without their knowledge, without their consent. We also have members who have been what I call socially sterilised, in the sense that they may not have undergone the surgical sterilisation, but they were led to believe and kind of brainwashed by, family, friends, everyone around them, that they would never be capable of having a child, looking after a child, having a intimate relationship. Mm. And so they've kind of, we have members now in their 40s and 50s who come to us saying that, you know, it's their biggest regret that they were never able to experience parenthood, experience what it's like to have a child, because they were always told from a very young age that they wouldn't be capable of it. So whilst they, you know, didn't undergo a surgical sterilisation, they in a sense were sterilised anyway, so, you know, by the attitudes and stereotypes around women with women and girls with disabilities. Mm. We have other members, you know, who talk about who were surgically sterilised, with often without their knowledge, certainly without their consent. Mm. You know, from young ages being told that they were going to hospital to have procedures such as, you know, their appendix out, or even, you know, for many of them, they didn't know what they were having. They would, you know, use language like they were having a procedure down there,
yeah,
but they had no idea of what that might be. Mm. Only to find out many years later that they had actually been sterilised. Mm. And you know, when you talk about impact, I mean the impacts are lifelong. Mm. You know, there's the physical impacts of, you know, surgically sterilising a young woman before her body's had the opportunity to develop in a kind of normal way.
Yes.
But there's also those lifelong psychological impacts, which, you know, nobody's ever been really that interested in. Mm. Much of the kind of history, debate, literature around this issue in Australia has been caught up in very much in a medical legal context. And the thing that's noticeably absent through all of that is the voices and the perspectives of women with disabilities themselves. You know, people with disabilities generally have always had experts sort of making decisions on their behalf. Mm. And you know, that's no different around this issue either. So in terms of impacts, you know, we've had women talk about it as an enormous betrayal, you know, absolute breach of their trust in people that they believed, you know, loved them and cared for them. A great sort of grief and sadness and loss, impacts on their sense of self, their sense of what it means to be a woman, their relationships, their potential relationships. Mm. I mean, it's far reaching, and it's something that's been you know, largely ignored, and certainly not researched, you know, at all in this country, apart from the work that's been done by WIDA and, you know, the Human Rights Commission.
Yes. And the other thing, apart from the psychological and the long-term psychological impact, I guess, would be the long-term physical health impact that these sorts of medications can have.
Well, absolutely, and we know very little about that. You know, in terms of that's not been sort of like considered areas of research. But we know, you know, that, you know, certainly, you know, early onset menopause, you know, to remove the healthy organ of a 9, 10, 11-year-old girl, that, you know, an organ that she, you know, their body parts that they actually need, is, you know, extremely problematic when you're looking at things like early onset menopause, osteoporosis, and all sorts of things. You know, I mean, I'm not a medical expert.
No.
But, you know, the physical implications are potentially horrendous.
Sure.
Not to mention things like the use of injectable, you know, long-term contraceptives, on the impact on future fertility.
Mm.
You know, drugs like Depo-Provera and similar drugs like that are well known to actually have, you know, major sort of effects on fertility. So, yeah, there's so much that we don't know, and that just hasn't been done. But that's also, you know, couched, I think, very much in the sense that women with disabilities are not treated the same as other women.
Yep. Carolyn, why is this still happening? Why are women and girls with disabilities still being sterilised in Australia? Aren't there other options?
Yeah, well, of course there are other options, but I think at the end of the day it gets first and foremost back to, you know, attitudes, society's attitudes around people with disabilities generally, and then women and girls with disabilities specifically. I mean, there is a very much a gendered aspect to that. you know, women with disabilities are either viewed as asexual or, you know, sexually promiscuous. It seems to be an either or.
Yes.
You know, it's done from a basis of fear. From a parent's perspective, it's also done as, again, around a fear of what might happen in the future, you know, when the parent can no longer take care of that young girl. The main reasons, there seems to be some fairly common themes, and they are to do with, one is very strongly about burden of care. It seems to be like to remove the ability to menstruate is almost like reducing, taking away a problem. So it's one problem that carers don't have to deal with.
Yes.
So that's kind of often used as a justification for allowing, for authorising the procedure. There's also obviously another reason another reason approvals are sought and given is around fear of reproducing, so fear of pregnancy, future pregnancy, and there's an odd one that is an odd theme, but which doesn't sort of seem to make a lot of sense, but it's a very common theme in the sort of family court approvals, is to do with a prevention of sexual assault, which in actual fact it can actually have quite the opposite effect. It can make women and girls with disabilities easier targets for sexual assault. So those are sort of like the common themes that seem to come through.
The data is very hard to pin down on this, isn't it? I mean, we've gone back a while, and in 1997, a report released by the then Commissioner Elizabeth Hastings showed that courts and tribunals have authorised a total of 17 sterilisation of girls since Marion's case in 1992. But data collected by the Health Insurance Commission showed that in that same period, at least 1,045 girls have been sterilised over that same period of time. And both of those pieces of data are a long time ago, but a more recent survey done by WIDA and the Commission have also failed to obtain data from all courts and tribunals. Why do you think the exact figures are so difficult to get?
I'm not exactly sure. I think it's, you know, there are... I don't know, Graham, why that's all the case. I think there's also potentially some dodgy sort of things that happen around data in terms of how the procedure may or may not be classified, you know, within the sort of hospital setting. So if something is classified, you know, there may be a procedure done that actually results in a sterilisation but is not actually classified as a sterilisation, surgical sterilisation. So I think the whole issue around data is really problematic. However, I have to say that I get a bit tired sometimes of journalists ringing me up asking me, well, how many? Many are being done, as if one is okay. I've always been quite perplexed by those questions because we, you know, back in 1994 and 95, the Australian government showed, you know, great leadership around the issue of female genital mutilation, for example, and enacted legislation and, you know, had bodies like the Australian Medical Association drafting up position statements and, you know, there wasn't this great debate about how many were being done. It was like this, you know, we consider in Australia that female genital mutilation is a fundamental breach of a young girl's, you know, human right to bodily integrity, therefore we will do this to make it stop.
So why isn't the situation the same?
Why this issue is treated so differently. And it's like, it's very odd that we have legislation in this country that prevents children from having solariums and prevents children from having cosmetic surgery, because it's seen as they're not old enough to make that decision, and it's about their right to bodily integrity, etc., etc.
Yeah.
We don't actually, I haven't seen great data collection processes around how many children are having solariums or, you know, so I'm really perplexed at why this issue just gets so caught up in numbers. Does that make sense?
Yes, yes, no, that's helpful. What does international law say on this? Do you think that international law is clear on an obligation to prohibit involuntary or coerced sterilisation under international human rights law?
I think international human rights law is very clear.
Yeah.
And certainly Australia is dragging its feet in this area. The United Nations has made it crystal clear to the Australian government, successive Australian governments since, you know, probably 2004, in black and white through a range of treaty bodies and monitoring committees, that this is a practice that must be stopped,
yes.
That must be prohibited, that needs national leadership, that it is not good enough for the Australian government to leave it to states and territories to regulate, that it's an issue that requires strong national leadership and needs to be stopped immediately.
Yeah.
Now, this has come from, treaty bodies such as the Convention on the Rights, the Committee on the Rights of the Child, the Committee Against the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, Australia's Universal Periodic Review. There are so many areas where this has been made really clear to the Australian government. So
yeah.
I'm not sure about what the delay is. There's also been some quite recent findings the European Court of Human Rights, very strong findings against, say, for example, the Roma women who were sterilised without their consent. And so, only last week, I think, three women were, had their case upheld and are now, seeking compensation for that. So there's a number of precedents that have been set. Around the world, and Australia really, the Australian government needs to kind of lift its game.
Well, what should the Australian government do? What measures should be taken to protect people with disability from involuntary or coerced sterilisation?
Well, I think first and foremost, it needs a national response. We need national leadership on the issue, and we do need, certainly in the case of minors, it's a practice that needs to be prohibited, so we do need a legislative response at a national level, and for adults, again, legislated around in the absence of their free and informed consent. Without that, it actually can't happen. So that's first and foremost. From WIDA's point of view, it's never ever just been about the need for a legislative response. We need a whole suite of reforms to kind of underpin that. So we need education and training of, a whole range of service providers, health professionals, medicos, disability service providers, you name it. But we also need much better support and services for women with women and girls with disabilities themselves, in terms of learning about their bodies, about how to manage their menstruation, about how to remain safe from violence and sexual violence, and how to form healthy relationships, respectful relationships. So there's a whole kind of suite of work that needs to be done. And also, I think one thing that's really clear is that for a lot of parents, particularly who seek to have, seek approvals through the family courts and guardianship boards to have their daughters sterilised, it's often, at the end of the day, it's not so much that they want to have their daughters sterilised, it's the fact that they don't, that they want support, they want help, they need... it's often they are acting in what they believe is the best interests of their child in terms of the circumstances that they find themselves in. So, yeah, that's the sort of thing that, we need. And I think on top of that, we also need strong mechanisms for women and girls with disabilities who have been surgically sterilised without their consent. We need a whole raft of avenues for them to be able to seek counselling and support and services to deal with that.
Yeah. Well, Caroline, thanks for talking with me today. A really fundamental issue about women's bodily integrity, which we'll continue to watch.
You're very welcome, Graham. Thanks for inviting me.
And there is, of course, a Senate inquiry taking place on this issue as we speak. The inquiry is open for submissions, and you can find out more details about that on the Australian Parliament House site at www.aph.gov.au, all linked from the Disability Rights page of the Human Rights Commission site. And the Human Rights Commission submission should be on the Parliament House website by the time you're listening to this podcast. So thanks to all of you for listening to PodRights. Remember, this podcast is for you. So if you have a suggestion of someone with whom I should talk or a comment on the podcast, please email me at podrights@humanrights.gov.au or find me and message me on Facebook or Twitter. Just search for Graham Innes, GraeMeInnes. Also, if you want to engage more on human rights issues, have a look at tellmesomethingidontknow.gov.au, our Something in Common project, where you can read fascinating human rights facts and stories, participate in polls, add your own content, and find out what you can do to advance human rights issues in Australia. And keep your podcatchers ready for the next PodRights in the series, because human rights are for everyone, everywhere, every day. I'm Graham Innes. Goodbye for now.